fighting for America.
I can promise you one more thing. Even if Israel has to stand alone, Israel will stand.
Fighting for Idaho.
The Iranians, when they sat down, said, look, we want you to know that we're going to work towards a treaty. If we get there, though, it's got to go to our equivalent of a parliament, and they've got to approve it. You mean to tell me that Iran, they've got a more representative government than America?
Fighting for you.
They're like, hey, this is a great location. I would love to be here, but there's a sentiment domain thing hanging over our head. It's a tough call.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the morning, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
You know, I hate that. I was going to say something to Julie Lindy a minute ago, and now we're on the air. Anyway, 580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning, Julie Lindy with us, Cornerstone Family Council. And last time we had you on, we were talking about the words. And any surprise that the words people are back and they're not happy? All they wanted was a hearing, and they had a hearing.
Yeah, not one shock at all, Kevin. You and I talked about this. We knew they'd be back, and they had said that they wouldn't be back, but you and I knew it, and here they are getting arrested and raising money for bail.
Amazing. Now, we have a very special guest in studio with us. Why don't you introduce her for our audience here at 580KIDO?
We have the wonderful statesman Representative Janet Trujillo with us, and she's been championing parental rights for a number of years. And this year, we have a wonderful bill, House Bill 113, that has made its way through the House and is moving on to the Senate.
Wow. Congratulations on accomplishing that. We a lot of frustration sometimes, and welcome.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here. And, yes, it is a lot of frustration. Anytime you try to convince 105 people that they need to be on board, it's always exciting.
Let's talk a little bit about this because, again, at 580KIDO, we've mentioned it a few times. Is there a need for parental rights here in Idaho? Most people, you know, they have their kids, they raise their kids, and, you know, is this something the legislature needs to get involved in, ma'am?
I would say absolutely. You know, we as parents assume we have rights, but there is nothing codified in the statutes of Idaho that give you your fundamental right, which means that here in Idaho, our rights are basically ordinary rights. And if I can explain, there's three different types of rights within the eyes of the law. There's an absolute right, which the government cannot restrict in any way. There's a fundamental right, in which there is a two-prong test. They have to show that it is necessary and that it is least intrusive when that right is infringed upon. And then the ordinary rights, we can restrict them. Government can get involved in any way possible. And so we need to make sure that as parents we maintain that fundamental right process.
You know what, you'd think that it just is common sense that parents have the rights.
Well, most people listening would say, yeah.
Yeah. People are saying, well, why do we need this? Of course we have parental rights. They're our kids. It's not the state's kids. Yet in reality, we need to now put this in statute because it's a brave new world that we live in. And since 2000, parental rights have been eroded consistently in the courts as well as in other places.
Well, if you could, ladies, if you could give us some examples of that, because you have a lot of folks, and we know this, that are very conservative, very family-friendly here at 580KIDO, that are going to say, why should the government sanction my rights given to me by God?
First of all, I would
it's
have to say...
It's always easier to ask the questions than
easier
it is.
It's easier to ask.
This is true.
You know, I think one of the things we're dealing with in this, what I've called the brave new world, is that the government doesn't necessarily respect that something is given by God. And so the courts now have to have boundaries, as do other governmental entities. You know, you look at the Justina Pelletier case, I think it was in Massachusetts or Pennsylvania, where the hospital just took the Pelletier's child away from them. And it took them a long time to be able to not only just see their daughter, but to get her home. And now she's suffering some medical effects from that. There are cases since the 1900s, early 1900s, that have affirmed parental rights, but and Representative Trujillo can talk about this Supreme Court case, the Troxell case, but at that time, and that was in 2000, that case is kind of what turned everything on its head. And since then, there have been at least, let's see what I've got here, 24 or 25 cases in federal courts that have explicitly rejected the use of the strict scrutiny case in parental rights cases. So those cases now are treating parental rights as ordinary rights rather than fundamental.
And it's really difficult to want to give an example because then people want to focus on just that example. And here in the state of Idaho, the truth is that this is to set that fundamental rights are a parental rights basis that we want our courts to look at. In Idaho, it's not necessarily case specific.
Well, and again, you're going to have a lot of people saying, psh, do we really need this? You ladies say that we have the House has agreed it goes to the Senate. What's been the discussion like concerning this bill?
It's been very interesting. I think the most heartache that people have is the word education. They do not like the fact that we have the word education in there, even though there is strong Supreme Court precedence in this area. In the state of Idaho, based on our Constitution, there's a lot of people that believe that the state actually has the rights over the parents.
Really?
Correct.
Julie?
We heard comments in the House hearing that one person who surprisingly was also part of the Add the Words crowd, one person stood up and said, you know, parents are good people, but a lot of times they don't know what they're doing. They don't understand education. They don't understand child development. And so they need the state to step in and help them out, as if the state could do a better job just as a principle. And what we're trying to enshrine here is the principle of fundamental parental rights.
What happens if this bill isn't approved by the Senate and the governor? What are the dangers then? Could we see, as you've mentioned, that the state is all of a sudden dictating how people raise their kids?
Well, and as we see this happening across the states, yes. You know, right now what's happening, our judges are actually legislating from the bench. And how many times do you hear that that's not a good thing?
Sure.
There is no state statute to give guidance. At this point, I agree with the decisions that we have from our courts. We just want to make sure and ensure that our courts continue to give us the results that we have now.
And the courts need, as well as attorneys, need some boundaries. A lot of times what we've seen on some of these cases is that since there are no boundaries, the court just rules and oftentimes rules as a default that the state would have the rights of the parent. When in reality, what this has done is put families at imminent danger of government intrusion into the parent-child relationship and separating it. And there have been instances where Child Protective will get involved, which is such a good agency in many ways, but they don't, Child Protective, for some reason, you just can't quite get a bead on where they're going on things because sometimes they overdo it and sometimes they underdo it. And something like this will help put some boundaries around the parental rights issue.
Right. Any other folks there that have an issue with it? Again, you get scared when all of a sudden people say, well, the government needs to raise the kids. Hillary Clinton talking about it takes a village. You're referencing Huxley's Brave New World where children are born in hatcheries and not with parents, and we kind of see that today. Do you two believe that parents have been devalued in our society today?
I think parents have been devalued, actually. I think a lot of traditional morality and traditional values, the stuff that made America what America is, which is such a great, great nation, has been devalued over the course of time, whether it's within the culture, within the education system, or within the courts. There's just something going on that says that the church needs to, or the state needs to step into the church. The state needs to step into the family. The state needs to step between the parent-child relationship. And there comes a time where the family has to stand up and say enough is enough.
And that's what this bill does?
I believe that's what this bill does. And it does it in a very modest way, really. It just says what we've known all along, that this is a God-given right, and the state needs some boundaries.
Where do we go from here? It goes to the Senate?
It goes to the Senate, yes. And we will have a hearing early next week on this particular bill. I'm excited to get over and talk with our senators. Mm-hmm. We've been working with them. And explain exactly what the bill does. You know, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there as to what exactly it does. A lot of misunderstanding of what the two-pronged test is within the eyes of the law and how that actually strengthens parental rights.
Sure, and the two-pronged test?
The two-pronged test is that the state has to prove that it is the least intrusive way possible and that they actually have the compelling interest.
All right, much more coming up. Phone numbers here, 580-5436, 580-KIDO. If you have a question concerning parental rights and the idea of the state regulating itself, and regulating the state before they take your kids from you, if that is a fear.
Getting more done before sunrise than anyone. Kevin Miller in the morning on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Up all night. 580 KIDO, we continue on talking about the parental rights issue here. Let's talk a little bit about culturally where we are in Idaho compared to the rest of the nation. Ladies, how do you think that we stand out compared to, let's say, Washington or Oregon? You both are, you know, you care about the family. That's why we have this proposed, this bill, this legislation going forward. Where are we as far as protecting the family?
You know, in Idaho, we're really blessed because we are a lot more traditional and conservative than places like Washington, California, New York, Oregon. However, we don't have a fence around us, and we are all connected via the internet, and the courts are connected as well in terms of what decisions get made. So we're not an island here in Idaho, and as things continue on in the federal courts, Idaho does get affected. And as Common Core moves through the schools get affected. There's a case in another state where a student said that he complained that his parents were taking him to church too much. And the teacher said, well, you need to contact Child Protective Services. So he did. And it never went to trial. But what happened is they took the child out of the home, put him in foster care until the parents agreed to not take him to church so much. So it's things like that that happen, and, you know, you just go, how does that stuff really happen? How does it get that far?
I think most people, though, believe that, hey, it's, you know, he's my kid, she's my kid, and who's the government to tell me how to raise my kid? But now all of a sudden you're having government intervene if they go to church too much?
Well, that was just one instance, and that was relayed by an attorney on the national level, and it never did go to trial. So when he talked about it, he changed their names and stuff. But, yeah, that stuff happens, and a lot of it is because there is a lot of extra effort put on to teachers. Now they got to feed them breakfast and lunch and be the parent to a degree at school because of whatever reason. And so sometimes I think the education establishment tends to take over without really realizing it. I don't think it's a nefarious thing on anybody's part, but that's an instance of what happened in school. And then we talked about Justina Peltier, what happened at a hospital. And then you look at courts when parental rights can be, you know, denied a parent over a certain circumstance that may or may not be valid. The state may not have a compelling interest to take away those parental rights. And they may do it in a more intrusive manner, which means they've violated both of those points of the two-pronged test. And as a parent, you're now in the process of paying for attorneys, trying to keep your kids at home, trying to do your best, and all the rest of the stuff you've got to do in your life. And it's just very, very difficult for parents.
And see, that's where this bill comes in to protect parents.
Absolutely. And it is interesting that you bring up Oregon, because back in 1923 is really when a lot of parental rights were starting to be discussed. And in Pierce versus Society, and under the Meyer and Nebraska case, that's when parental rights really started to be talked about. And they came about because of an Oregon law. And so under the doctrine of Meyer, Nebraska, they stated, we think that it is entirely plain that the Oregon law unreasonably interferes with the liberty of parents and guardians to direct the upbringing and education of children. The state is not the mere creature, or the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right and high duty to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. So these are talks that have been going on for, you know, 90 years at least.
Right.
And there is Supreme Court precedence in this. However, lower courts since 2000, which is the Troxell case, in which the courts sided with the parents, but they did not state specifically that those rights were fundamental. And so it kind of downgraded it. Now courts are looking at things a little differently. So, you know, in this case, I truly believe that there really are some things that we can set into place in the state of Idaho that absolutely says, yes, our parents are important, and we want them to have those fundamental rights.
580-5436, Kevin at KIDOAM.com. You know, again, you have people coming in, dropping their kids off to school even as we speak. I think they're going to be shocked to know that we need this legislation, but you folks believe that it's going to happen. Do you believe it'll get through the Senate and the governor will sign it?
It is my hope that we do. Again, I believe that, you know, we have court precedents even in the Idaho courts as of February of 2014 that state basically what our bill says, and that is that parents have the fundamental right concerning the care, custody, and control of their children. We have just inserted, because of Supreme Court precedents, the word education as well.
This is really important. It's one of those things that's a proactive measure. Often we get criticized for saying, why are you reactionary? Why are you against?
You are a radical reactionary.
Well, that, I've got my radical reactionary card. It's right next to my right-wing radical card.
See, yes.
But this is proactive. This is something that's saying, you know what? We're looking at what other states are experiencing. We're looking at things that are happening in and out of the courts, even in Idaho, and we're saying this needs to happen before it gets worse. And we're trying to eliminate the chaos. And those who oppose this bill are actually trying to interject chaos. And so to that point...
When you mean interject chaos, and pardon me for interrupting, what do you mean?
Well, all of the doom and gloom stuff, you know, like the lady who said that, you know, parents might be nice people, but they're stupid. or people saying that somebody's going to come into the classroom and...
Well, no, a kid would never say that about their parents, but no, I digress, yes.
No, yeah. But the people that say some parent is going to come into a classroom and demand Sharia law, those kinds of things are ridiculous because that just can't happen. For all the decades that parents have assumed they've had this right, and we should have this right, things like that have never happened. And a classroom and a teacher in a classroom has a lot more power than to just look at a parent and say, oh, okay, we're going to teach about Lent or we're going to teach about something else just because you demand it. That's the kind of chaos I'm talking about.
One thing, though, that has been brought up in Oregon and a little here is the idea of vaccinations and the idea of getting treated for medical illnesses. You know, has that been brought up in this opposition to this legislation where the state says, you know, they're looking at denying parents the right to say, no, we don't want our kid vaccinated. They're looking at, you know, the idea if your religion believes that medical treatment isn't the way to go, and as a parent you have a right to say that, looking to take that away. What about your concerns there? Has that been brought up at all?
That particular one has not been brought up to me specifically. Now, whether or not somebody in the background is thinking it, you know, these are the types of things that, you know, saying that a parent has a fundamental right, it protects against that. Because, again, there's the two-prong test. The state has to show compelling interest. And then when it does that, it has to show that it is the least intrusive means.
What we're doing here is enshrining a principle. We're not saying that this specific event has to occur in a court in this specific way. We're enshrining a principle for the broader good. The rights of parents to care for the care, custody, and education of their children is a principle that needs to be enshrined. And underneath that umbrella is where the courts and where all these other issues need to get ferreted out. But right now we don't even have the umbrella, so we need that.
What would you like people to do?
Well, we would like people to contact their senators. The Senate State Affairs Committee needs to hear from you, as well as the entire Senate. Let them know how you feel about this. You can go to the legislative website to get addresses. And also, our Cornerstone website on the homepage has a drop-down that specifically talks about this parental rights issue. It has the bill. It has a Q&A, and it gives some more talking points as to what we've discussed with you today. And that website is CFC, so Cornerstone Family Council, cfcidaho.org.
And the other thing that you can do is when you are contacting your legislatures, remember that we want courteous conversations with them. This is an important issue.
Right.
And so
don't call them at home at like 10 o'clock
right,
at night.
Right, exactly. Just remember that we want to be courteous when we make these contacts, but we want them to know that parental rights are important.
Indeed. We thank both of you for coming in.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Your show is always awesome.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the bell here. You're listening to 580KIDO.
Sean Hannity, weekdays at 3. Now, back to Kevin Miller on 580KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning as we continue on. Phone numbers 580-5436, 580-KIDO. John Guandola with us, a former FBI special agent, Marine counterterrorism expert. Also, understandingthethreat.com joins us to talk about the ISIS threat. Good morning, sir.
Hey, how you doing, Kevin?
Good to have you with us. Good. Sorry to keep you waiting there. First of all, thank you for your service, both with the Marines, graduating the Naval Academy, and with the FBI. That's quite a lot of accomplishments.
Well, thank you very much for saying so. Just doing my part.
Well, you take a look at the world we live in today. How scary, how dangerous is it?
Well, I would say it's obviously we have some significant issues, but I think the greatest concern to me is that we are focused solely, I believe, both the citizens of the United States and our government on the ISIS and what they're doing overseas. But there is a massive jihadi network here in the United States that's supporting training and raising up generations of jihadis here that's made up of some of the largest and most prominent Islamic organizations. And we're not only doing anything about it, the government in the form of the White House and members of Congress and some of the law enforcement and intelligence agencies are turning to the leaders of these organizations for advice on how to, wage the war on terrorism. And that, in my professional opinion, is the greatest downfall we're facing right now.
Well, it sounds like the truth is it's too scary to believe that we have these networks in this country. And sir, you'd have some people saying, well, if that's the case, why haven't they attacked us here?
Well, I think when you understand what the nature of the threat is, this is the global Islamic movement right now is focused primarily on the Islamic countries. Their own strategy has said they're focused on imposing Sharia first in the Islamic countries, and then when they believe they've done that, at least in the preponderance of the countries, they'll turn towards the West, towards Europe first and then the United States and Canada. So what you're seeing now in the acts of jihad you're seeing now are more individual acts of jihad. And then when they're organizational, like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Taliban, Boko Haram, Abu Sayyaf, Al-Shabaab attacks, those are coming less frequently because their focus is not on the West. It's on Muslim countries in Africa and Asia and the Middle East.
What are we doing wrong as far as battling them for the hearts and minds? Do we really get who and what they're about?
No, I don't think we do. I think how can you battle for the hearts and minds when 14 years into a war, nowhere in our national security apparatus, nowhere in our national security documents have we identified the enemy? I mean, we keep coming up with new terms since 2001. That have nothing to do with who these guys are. 100% of these people say that they are Muslims waging jihad in the cause of Allah to impose Sharia, Islamic law, and establish the Islamic State. And in fact, that's what they say. It's what they say in open court. It's what they say in videotapes, in their writings, on the web. It's what they say when we arrest them. It's what they say prior to or after committing acts of jihad. And in fact, 100% of all Sharia Islamic law obliges jihad until the entire world is under Sharia. There's no such thing as a version of Islamic law that doesn't require that. So starting there is the key, because we can't talk from a law enforcement perspective of how to best recruit assets or how to interview people or what to do during a search warrant or a traffic stop. And on a military perspective, we can't talk about how we're dealing with villagers or how we're dealing with enemy soldiers or jihadis found on the battlefield. And at a foreign policy level, we can't talk about how to deal with these countries unless we understand that and understand internationally that the every Islamic country is a signer and a part of the Organization of Islamic Conference who's signed and sent treaties to the United Nations saying that their understanding of human rights is the Sharia, and that they only understand human rights via the Sharia, which is to impose Islamic law. So all of this goes together to give us an understanding of what the enemy is, except we're not incorporating that into any of our strategies or our war fighting.
Let's talk about your book, Raising a Jihadi Generation, a Jihadi Generation. How did this happen? Is this, we're aware of it now. You know, in the old days, it was the Palestinians, the PLO. Instead of kids on their books counting apples, they were counting rifles. How is that different from what we faced in the past?
Well, it's different in a couple big ways. Number one, the entire Islamic framework in the United States, the Islamic community, I know based on evidence, especially evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial. The U.S. versus Holy Land was the largest terrorism financing and Hamas trial ever successfully prosecuted in American history in Dallas in 2008. And that's a 15-plus year FBI investigation. And at the time it was indicted, the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Islamic charity in America, and it was a Hamas organization. And what the evidence revealed, historical documents, I mean, we had a 2004 FBI raid in Annandale, Virginia, where the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood were discovered. And all of that, plus this 15-year investigation, the evidence revealed that the most prominent Islamic organizations in the United States today, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Student Association, Muslim American Society, many of the others, are all part of this Muslim Brotherhood network whose stated objective is civilization jihad. And to overthrow the United States government and impose Sharia law. And so if that has been proved, which it has, through evidence in a court, and that a group like the Council on American Islamic Relations was created to be a Hamas organization in the United States, and yet these organizations are the leaders, these are the ones that we see our government entities interfacing with. And only interfacing with, as a matter of fact, in the Muslim community. So then you end up making horrible foreign policy decisions, horrible combat decisions, and destructive law enforcement decisions, because the people you're taking advice from are terrorists. As a matter of fact, by the way.
What do you make of, as a matter of fact?
Right.
What do you make?
No, I'm saying...
Yeah, I'm sorry.
As a matter of fact, yeah, those things are on the record through evidence.
What do you make of Eric Holder saying we're not at war with radical Islam?
I'd call that delusional. Who are we at war with then? What is the, again, we don't get to choose who our enemies are. They've declared war on us. And so we need to just live in that reality. I think one of the, when you talk about, the political left and the jihadis and where they meet and merge and where they don't. I think where we're getting killed in this issue today is our leadership doesn't live in reality. I mean, it seems like they're in a land of like pink clouds and unicorns, and it's a problem. There's a reality that there is an organized global movement that's well funded, well organized, and well led. And it is, obviously, as you're watching, taking over countries, killing tens of thousands of people. And our government leaders, like Mr. Holder, are saying, well, it's just, this isn't what it is. Well, what is it? just I'd love to hear what it is. It's not just a disparate group of people who are just randomly fighting. There's a commonality here.
When we take a look at the beheadings and the killings of the Christians, is there a method to that?
Well, what do you mean? Is there a method to it? I mean, everything they do and the whole way, the whole filter of their understanding the world is the Sharia, is Islamic law. And you, by the way, for your listeners, you can purchase authoritative Islamic law published in English, you know, on Amazon.com from all over the world. So long as it's written by a recognized Muslim authority for a Muslim audience, it's authorized Islamic law. Books written for us by non-authorities, and even those written by authorities but not for Muslim audiences, are written differently. But if you get, and by the way, the reason that most Islamic law is written in English is because most of the largest Islamic countries were British colonies, and so the legal language is English. So you don't need to get a translation of authoritative Islamic law. And if you buy 100 books of authoritative Islamic law, what you're going to find is 100% of those books say that jihad is obligatory until the entire world is under Islamic rule. There's no other version of it. And so we just need to begin that. That doesn't mean that everyone that self-identifies themselves as a Muslim is a threat or an enemy. But the Sharia is uniform, and there's no such thing as a Sharia that doesn't mandate those things. And so when you look at beheadings, crucifixions, stoning, that's all a part of authoritative sacred Islamic law.
UnderstandingTheThreat.com. John, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me, Kevin.
All right. We'll have more.
Glenn Beck, weekdays at 9. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning as we continue on. Phone number is 580-5436, 580-KIDO. Rachel Sutherland joining us from Fox News Radio. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
So Hillary Clinton says she wants everybody to see your emails. Everybody, some people say she didn't break the law. Other people say she did. Heck, almighty Maureen Dowd referencing 1996. I remember the 1996.
Oh, yeah, me too. A lot going on.
So we could say that about the former Secretary of State as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, she is in some hot water here with these emails. Now we're hearing Fox News obtained a cable from the State Department back from 2011 when she was Secretary of State, in which she directed staff not to use personal email accounts while she herself was doing that and apparently had this server somewhere in a basement. So it's not looking good for her, at least as far as the way it's perceived. However, you know, I was talking with a colleague this morning, and he said, look, you know, if Hillary Clinton wants to get elected in 2016, she'll get elected. But you have to wonder about some of the implications if there's some classified information that may have been on the server. That could run – she could run to the mud that way.
Not only that, but, you know, with respect to your colleague's cynicism there, what does it say about us if we do elect her and she did break laws and if nothing else, she broke standard practices that, as you've reported, would have staffers fired?
In fact, yeah, according to this report that we obtained here at Fox, there was, I believe it was the ambassador to Kenya at the time in 2011-2012 timeframe, was definitely chastised for using his private email account doing the same thing. And he was ultimately he was kind of forced to resign. There was a Inspector General report that was going to come out that wasn't going to look good for him, so he stepped down before that happened. And among the issues in the report, and there were other things, there was the issue of using a private email account. So it could have contributed to him sort of being pushed out.
Right. And again, it comes down to, you know, are there standards or not? And you know, Rachel, as someone who covers Congress and the White House and all things Washington, you know, you're going to have people lobbying on the other half. But if it's the law is the law, you know, who is going to investigate her? It won't be Loretta Lynch. It won't be Eric Holder. It won't be the president. Would it be Congress?
That's interesting. I think that's maybe getting a little ahead of it. But who knows? I mean, this Congress wouldn't be a fan of Hillary Clinton. I don't know if there would be some kind of investigation that way. It has begun at the State Department, though, at least Secretary of State John Kerry saying that that they would begin the process immediately to review some, I don't know, 55,000 emails. Someone's going to have a long weekend ahead of them.
Rachel, thank you. Bye, KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning. Thank you all for joining us. Coming up, we'll take a look at the events going on at Fox News, Fox News Radio, and always stay tuned with us. Like I said, we are expanding our social media presence. Would love you to give us a like, 580KIDO, KIDO AM Boise. Those are our Facebook posts, at 580KIDO on Twitter. And friend me, because gosh knows I need more friends. That's Kevin Miller on Facebook. Fox News is next. Stay here, stay informed. You're listening to Kevin Miller, 580KIDO.